welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. Once again, we are being brought to you by the Booked Anthology, and they just had their launch party, so it's like a real thing now. We're here with Jason Riddler, author of Triumph for Sakura, Blood and Sawdust, Deathmatch. As I mentioned in the Books and Booze discussion group, one of the most interesting biographies I've ever read. This is Renee, and I'm drinking the Stone Brewery Collaboration R&R Coconut IPA, and it's really good. I don't regret that decision at all. Jason, how are you doing, and what are you drinking?
I'm doing swimmingly, and I'm having a G&T.
Nice.
Nice. Oh,
what gin are you using?
Bombay Sapphire.
Ooh.
That sounds fancy.
It isn't.
I actually put a bottle of it on my floor once. In my
Yeah, it's a very classy looking bottle.
Yeah. Hmm. It wasn't my finest moment. But. Jessica, what do you got? Are you drinking the pumpkin ale?
You just stole my thunder.
I did. Sorry. I got excited.
It's a very special night on Books and Booze because I'm getting to drink my first, not my first, but the first one on this show of the Blue Moon Harvest Pumpkin Ale of this year. And I'm super excited. Oh, I had a minor, fit in the store when I saw it. It was really exciting for me.
See, I got excited because I almost, it didn't happen, but because it used to be the first few. For a while there, Jessica was always drinking the pumpkin ale, and I was always drinking Raging Bitch. And my beer store finally got Raging Bitch in, and I got super fucking excited, but then I realized that they had these Stone collaborations, and the guy was like, I'm not getting any more of them in, and if you don't buy it before the weekend, all the people who party on the weekends are going to buy them. So I had to put the Raging Bitch back and buy the other beer.
Mm. Beer choice.
Wow.
It was a Sophie's choice, let me tell you.
Wow.
What are you drinking?
Fairly despondent choosing, yes.
I'm being fancy as always, just a rum and coke. I'm very boring. You know, I guess I haven't ever had a gin drink the right way. I've only drank it straight, and I find it a little disgusting. But
yeah, it takes a bit of getting used to. I've got a sort of sad, long relationship with gin that goes back to, I don't want to say how long ago, but I was before the age of majority, and in the dark, cold Canadian winter, buddies of mine would do our best to find something to warm us up, and I drank lemon gin straight for a good long time, and it's so sad. Tom Waits could have written a song about it, about a couple of drunk kids in a pile of snow drinking lemon gin, barely staying alive.
There seems to be a big correlation between writers and gin. It seems like they're always drinking it, and I feel like I'm left behind. One day I'll learn to love it. Yeah.
Well, it can be an acquired taste. It's got a bit of a bitter kick as opposed to a rum and coke, so it's not to drink for all seasons.
Whenever somebody says that any alcohol is an acquired taste, because that just means they had a huge commitment to getting drunk on that drink.
Right? That's what I've got.
I don't like it, but I'm going to drink it 20 more times because I'm getting used to this shit.
I feel like I don't believe in acquiring a taste for alcohol. There's enough alcohol in the world that tastes good just when you drink it.
Hell or high water. I'm going to learn to love this one.
You know what? No, I think that is a myth because I still hate scotch and black coffee, though I've been drinking it for years and I still hate it, but I forced myself to do it.
You're so full of shit, Dakota. You give me crap all the time for putting milk in my coffee, and you're going to sit here and say you hate black coffee when you try to use that as a way to, be above me because I put a little milk in my coffee to cool it off so I can drink it
one
faster.
One day I'll learn to love it.
No, you're not. No, you suck. Okay.
And then you'll be in the room.
I love the dismissal of that argument. No, your evidence doesn't count. You suck.
No.
That's how it goes on this show.
No.
Duly noted.
I'm going to go on an empty stomach tonight, guys. I don't get dinner until after the show tonight, so be ready for it.
Okay. All right, well, let's Yay. Let's jump right into it. Renee mentioned I read A Triumph for Sakura,
mm-hmm.
and very exciting. It's good. I will say it's probably the most realistic book involving vampires that I've read.
Interesting.
I don't know how to... Because you could sort of take the vampires out of the book, and it would still be there if it was just people, but then you add vampires, and it makes it kind of more exciting. You blend together supernatural and pulp fiction, I think, with this, with the wrestling and then vampires. So what made you think that vampires and wrestlers would make a good combination?
Let's see. Well, I guess the long-sorted story is back in about 2003, I wrote the first short story that I thought had my own storytelling voice. It didn't sound like me just trying to imitate whoever, Harlan Ellis, Jim Thompson.
Anne Rice.
Well, she was never one of my heroes, but not that I poo-poo those that dig her. I got lots of friends who love her stuff, but she doesn't sing my tune, as they say. But the reason why it was my voice versus, you know, just the sum total of my influences was I'd been told for a long time that, like, you're supposed to write about all the stuff that you love and that you care about so that your work has more passion and drive and that enthusiasm carries itself into the prose and into the mind of the reader. The problem was all the people that were telling me this stuff had, like, cool stuff that they loved, and I'm like, I love pro wrestling. it's about, you know, a couple of shades higher than, you know, admitting you have a naughty book collection, you know. It's not classy. And on the other hand, I was like, you know what, I'd read a lot of vampire stories, and I really didn't like a lot of the stories I was reading, in part because the vampires were always beautiful. They were usually aristocratic. Even in Dracula, there's, you know, he comes from noble birth. So they're almost sort of like elves, you know. They're born better, or they're turned into creatures that are better than you. And for a sort of punk rock kid like me, I didn't like that. I'm like, well, what happened if you got bit and you were fat and ugly? You're stuck.
Yeah.
I mean, sure,
yeah,
you
that's
can,
a good point.
You can kick a lot of ass, but no one's going to be taking you to the prom. So what do you do? And the short story Blood and Sawdust came out of sort of answering that question for me. If, you know, a five-time loser got bit and then was like the toughest guy on two legs, if he actually got into fights, no one would probably believe that he won legitimately, and they'd say, fixed, and he'd be out of work. So I wrote a story about sort of a kid who discovers a vampire in the underground fight circuit who takes a beating, but he won't fight back. So he gets the loser's pay, but he's got a steady paycheck. And for a working class person, that's good enough. And it's the kid who's like, "No, you gotta dream bigger, man. You can do it. We can take all the tournaments." And the sort of launching point for that, answering that question, became the novel Blood and Sawdust. And I wanted to continue that journey a bit in A Triumph for Sakura, which was how to put it. I'd describe it as sort of million-dollar baby with vampires.
Yeah.
Because it's really about a relationship between a trainer and a fighter in a vampire-controlled United States, which is actually kind of modeled on Roman city-states, where everyone's sort of in their own fiefdoms. But I just like the idea of taking the supernatural and throwing it into the street. Too often it's like, oh, we're the secret society that's been around forever. Hooray! And I generally don't have much affinity for the aristocratic power bases, but I do have a lot of sympathy and empathy for folks on the wrong side of the track and fight their way back to getting their dignity, making a second chance work. And so I tend to throw the supernatural into those corners as opposed to something about, like, it's one of the reasons why I don't write much high fantasy is I have a hard time writing about kings and dukes and people of noble birth,
yeah,
and kind of that kind of stuff, in part just because I've served a lot of aristocrats as a young person, and I don't have a tremendous amount of patience for condescension.
Do you consider the Triumph for Sakura, is that like a sequel to Blood and Sawdust, or are they just in the same world, or are they even in the same world?
Not consciously. Though if I was smart, I'd do something about that. But no, it's Blood and Sawdust was its own beast, and actually, Triumph for Sakura came from Nancy Kilpatrick, who's like the queen of vampire horror fiction in Canada. Wonderful writer, lovely editor, and a great person. She and David Morrell, the guy who invented Rambo, and New York Times bestselling author, who's also a Canadian expatriate like me. He lives in New Mexico. They were doing an anthology called Tesseract 13, which was a long-time science fiction anthology, but these new publishers wanted to give it a horror edge because it was, you know, 13. They wanted to put it out around Halloween. And I submitted a story that they bought, which was great. And then Nancy was kind enough, when she was putting together a vampire anthology, to ask me to submit something. And what I submitted was a story called Blood That Burns So Bright. And that was sort of the climax of A Triumph for Sakura. It's about the sort of relationship between Ned and Sakura, where she's the only human who's sort of got the tools to beat a vampire in a fair fight or even an unfair fight. She's sort of an evolutionary anomaly, and she's going into the last round, and it's about whether or not she can take it because her body is breaking down. And whether or not she's willing to do something that would sort of dishonor her code of honor, or break her code of honor, and win, or maybe go out in a way that would be noble and beautiful. And Nancy bought it. She was like, wow, this was fantastic, loved it. And it was inspired by the Joe Louis Max Schmeling fights of the 1930s. Max Schmeling was I believe he was German-born American, and Joe Louis was African-American, and this is at a time when fascism is rising in Europe, Nazism is on the march, and their boxing matches became these sort of like hot flashpoints for the age, where Max Schmeling is considered to be the German Superman, and Joe Louis is considered to be inferior. And in the first match, Joe Louis loses. But the second one comes back like thunder. And there's this great line, and I've remembered to this day because I watched a documentary on it, where they asked Joe Louis, he's like, so, Joe, what do you think about your next match against Max Schmeling? He's like, I'm scared. They're like, what? You're scared? I'm scared I'm going to kill him.
Ooh.
And that inspired the sort of drive to see if I could write a story that could encapsulate that kind of a moment, sort of an era captured in a moment in time.
That's awesome. So that actually sort of leads me to a question that I had. I was wondering, and Dakota brought this up as well, how your academic background influences your writing. Because you're talking a little bit about history there, and I had to stop for a minute and when I was finishing up the book a couple nights ago, because you used the word recce in there, and that was something that even though I was in the military, I was like, what does this word mean in context to my husband? He's like, it's a military term. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense. And I was like, oh, wait, no, it does. So,
well, I'm glad it had clarity eventually. Oh, man.
Good work.
About, you mean like how much my academic training impacts the kind of stories I write?
Just not necessarily the type of stories you write, but just like what, like do you feel like it's bringing different elements into what you're writing? Because I know for our listeners at home, part of the amazing biography of Jason that I mentioned is that he is a war historian. So I'm just wondering, like, do you find yourself incorporating those things without even really realizing it and then going like, yeah, fuck yeah, I'm going to keep that.
Those are nice surprises when they happen, I guess. My academic career and my writing career kind of ran in parallel, or they run in parallel. when I started my graduate work at the Royal Military College of Canada as a civilian academic, I started writing fiction. But folks find this really strange, by and large, I don't write military-oriented fiction, military fantasy, science fiction, stuff of that nature. I have written about soldiers as protagonists more than a few times, but in sort of using the storehouse of knowledge of military history in the 19th and 20th century, which I've got from all of my training and my academic work, I think it's part of the mix. I can't escape it. But I had somebody. It was sort of a newish young writer who asked me why I didn't write about, like, why I didn't write military fiction. And I said, well, you know, I spend most of my time academically writing about the lives of others. My thesis was a biography, so I spent all my time telling somebody else's story to the best of my ability. When I come to fiction, I kind of want to take other parts of me and explore me through the lens of the fantastic or fiction or whatever it may be, instead of, you know, maybe just going to the well and saying, well, I really want to, maybe I could sell an alternative history Second World War story. I think the training helps. The kind of rigor I needed to get through the doctorate has stayed with me in fiction. I write fast. I'm disciplined. But in terms of content, it's kind of there as this reservoir of information that I can pluck from as needed, but it's not the focus. I know that was not the answer you were looking for.
No. No, it occurred to me, because like I said, I'm former military and my husband is currently military.
Right.
And so, I asked that question. I'm going to admit this and maybe I shouldn't, but whenever I don't know a word, I ask him. Because English people just sound smarter. I just figure he knows, right? No. But I asked him before I look it up in the dictionary, and that was one of the ones. I was like, what does this word mean? And I spell it. He's like, well, that's ready. And I'm like, okay. And then he explained, well, it's like, you know, reconnaissance, your information, you're this and that, and he's going into all the military stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, I get it. But, you know, it seemed kind of funny in that context for a minute, but then it was only kind of funny because I had to stop and figure it out. But, by the way, that's not an insult. Like, if you drive me to the dictionary, then I'm impressed. Or the dictionary being my husband
like
in this
that.
Case.
Oh,
you know,
well, I mean...
the famous feud between Faulkner and Hemingway, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, there's no winner in that fight except those that get to read their fiction. Two different kinds
exactly.
of writing. But that, I guess in A Triumph for Sakura, it was important because I picked Ned because I needed somebody who had a background that was, he was a Vietnam veteran. And that was integral to his side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess at the time that I wrote that, I was doing a lot of research on intelligence and reconnaissance units, long-range reconnaissance patrols or alert patrols, where guys who would be off in the bush for not just days but sometimes months collecting intelligence that could not be gathered in any other fashion and doing it, you know, under the nose of the enemy, behind enemy lines. And I was writing an actual biography of a guy who did that in the Second World War and then did similar stuff in the Philippines and Vietnam. And so, yeah, it was kind of at the ready, and I found there was something really compelling about being a soldier who, you know, traditionally most soldiers are used to precision drilling and working together so that the sum is greater than, you know, all the parts and all that jazz. But there are those particular elements in military life where you're really on your own, and the system and the machine that brought you there can't follow. And that had to be part of Ned's story.
I love the journey in that book that you get to go on with Ned. Because you start out just really sort of hating this guy. And then you know, I don't know, don't want to give away anything for other people who get to go on this journey, but you learn so much more about him as things go on. And you learn to accept Ned more for who Ned is.
Ned is special.
There's several characters in there, and they could easily come across as cliched or conventional. You know, like Ned's the old fight coach who wants another shot, and then you've got the underdog kid and all that. But I feel like you managed to give them a life in a way that was new and exciting, and I got to go on a journey and find out all this stuff about Ned. And I never felt like I was reading the same old story that I'd already read or seen before. Was that something, like, were you wary about those conventions when you started? Or did you already know
very
the characters?
Yes, very
much so.
Or? Oh, I mean, it's that sort of push and pull of the stories you love, but you don't want to just repeat them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I loved Million Dollar Baby. I loved the movie The Wrestler. I loved those kinds of the underdog tale. And I was very conscious of not only the tradition I was working in, but also, I guess, sort of against. Because I picked sort of unconventional characters to be underdogs. You know, Ned's African-American, Sakura's Japanese-American. These are not – I don't tend to see those kinds of characters in lead positions, and that was important to me. The story screamed for that kind of focus and attention, as well as the kind of tension. I mean, that was one of Ned's journeys is he's not happy with the way the world is, but the world that he knew also wasn't perfect either. So he struggles with that. And I'm really glad to hear that while he was difficult to enjoy at first, you kind of – either found empathy or sympathy, or at least understood that he's in part a creature of his time, and he's in many fashions a worse man would be far greater a menace to anything that is good and noble, and he's holding on by a sliver to do the best that he can. Which, I mean, that's sort of in general what I like to do in fiction is, you know, you find the characters you love and then you put them in a in a crock pot, and then you wait. and I'm not as indecent about it as George R. R. Martin is, but I want to make sure that if you're gonna have to care about them in some capacity. I don't really like. I mean, you can have, and noir is full of this, of characters that are interesting but are not likable.
Right.
Whose circumstances are so interesting and compelling that you're willing to follow Ripley through another adventure, even though Ripley's not a great guy, or to a lesser extent, some of the protagonists in Jim Thompson novels, who is one of my great mentors in terms of character. I mean, he's a story house for understanding the human condition and all of its many permutations. And he was getting paid a penny a word a lot of the time. Anyway, so I'm glad you like Ned. I keep hearing this from folks who have read the book and have actually been kind enough to come back to me to say this, like, I hated him, but then I understood him. I was kind of rooting for him.
Exactly.
And I'm pleasantly surprised because I've also, coinciding with that was, I don't know how many times I've received either letters or reviews that sort of like, I hate vampire stories because it's so boring, but this one's like anti-Twilight, so I liked it.
I will say it wasn't. It was definitely not a vampire story that I expected to read.
Oh,
it
very
wasn't
cool.
What I've been hearing, you know, what you see in pop culture right now and that type of thing. It was not that type of story. So even if you pick up the book and you see it, vampires, nope, I don't like that. That's not cool. I would give this one a try because it's definitely different than the vampires you're probably used to reading about. And there's also a lot of like social commentary going on in there because you talk a lot about the people with the power and how they use that power to control other people and the people who are lower down or just doing what they have to do. So there's a lot of layers to these wrestling vampires.
Vampire cake.
Yes, there are many. Yes, it's a resplendent devil angel food cake. The social commentary came, I guess, out of the construction of the world. Again, this was a case of, I guess Twilight was really raging, and the films were really popular when I was writing this, and wrote it pretty damn fast. But one thing I kept seeing, and I admit I've not read Twilight, I've just kind of got the basics of from osmosis from pop culture. And I asked myself,
obviously nobody on this show has read Twilight.
No.
Except for me.
But
anyway.
Wait, really?
Well said. Nobody has read it but me.
Well, I read the first three, and you know, it was this thing like I was staying with my mom at the time. My husband was deployed. I was staying with my mom for a few weeks, like just get a break from being at home alone, and I was like bitching to her about it, and she's like, "You know, you don't have to keep reading it." And I'm like, "You don't understand. I'm a completionist. I started. I'm gonna fucking finish it." And then I didn't, and it was like a breakthrough for me that I didn't read the final book. And everyone was like, "No, you don't understand. It gets so much better." And I was like, "No, fuck you. This is my Vietnam. I overcame it."
That was the helicopter from Saigon throwing down Twilight.
So I have a two-part question. I'm sorry. There's so many sirens around here. Hold on.
I hear that.
That's pretty ambient.
I even muted it so they would go by, and there's a straggler. Oh. Hold on a second. Okay. So I was wondering, do you have any personal experience with wrestling that prompted you to write about it in your books?
I gotta stop saying yes, in the sense that I've been a fan since childhood. I've written professional articles and got paid a decent wage to write about why pro wrestling is what it is. I've studied it in the same way that a lot of guys study sports, but there wasn't like a familial I didn't know anybody at school who went into it, or my dad wasn't an ex-wrestler from Winnipeg, Manitoba, or something like that. It was completely it hit me at the right time. It, like, hit me at the right time that, like, Star Wars and comic books and Dungeons & Dragons, RPG stuff, hit me at the right time. It was epic storytelling for primarily, you know, young guys who needed an escape. And as a kid, I did. And wrestling spoke to me in a way that, I wasn't as sort of prepared for it. It got in my head at the right time because it was comic books come to life, and it was this weird quasi, like, wrestling's fake, but it's real. You know, sports are real. Macbeth is a play. Wrestling, it's kind of both. You know, Ric Flair is Ric Flair when he's in his car going to the next, you know, gas station. And thank you. I was glad to hear a woo for the nature boy.
That's the second time Ric Flair has come up on this show, just by the way.
Oh, well, if it didn't come up during this one.
We're excited. We were talking in the pre-show about the wrestling, and I'm so glad because I said, I hope he's talking about, like, the old WWF-type wrestling because I grew up watching that, too, and that's really exciting to me.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I did. I grew up with where I was in Toronto, Ontario. We primarily got WWF. We also got the AWA. And we also got, like, we got these, like, well, there was two. There was Canadian wrestling. There was Stampede Wrestling, which I never saw, out in Calgary, which is where Bret Hart and the Hart family are from, the dynasty. And I will be the first to mention Bret the Hitman Hart's name on the show because he is the best there is, best there was, and best there ever will be.
Oh,
and
man.
He's a man. And
I'm just going to amend one of the questions that I had already planned.
It does.
Prescient of me. Prescient.
Go ahead.
The only other wrestling that was on that was an American, never saw British, never saw Japanese, never saw Mexican, like Lucha Libre stuff. But there were these two leagues, one in Montreal, which was around the Rougeau brothers' family. And it was pretty good wrestling for, you know, if nothing else was on. And then out in Vancouver, there was this reject league called All-Star Wrestling. And it was like filmed in some guy's, like a gymnasium. And everyone in the front row was the same every week. And it was the same, like, like loser high school kids who just came to wrestling because their dads worked there, and you could hear them screaming at the wrestlers, "You suck! This is fake!" And the all the wrestlers were like pale imitation of WWF stars. Like there was a guy named J.R. Bundy instead of King Kong Bundy, and he was a big, fat, bald guy who splashed people. It was circling the drain when I was watching, and eventually, of course, went under. But I just remember watching it and thinking, like, that's somebody's dad. You know, that this is like the saddest wrestling on earth. There's no huge crowds, no spotlight, no explosions. And yet this guy's going to get out of the ring, take a shower, get in his car, and then go to Flin Flon and then Medicine Hat. And so I spent, after I, you know, I was a late bloomer when I realized wrestling wasn't real. And after that, I was like, okay, it's not real, so it's kind of like theater, like a movie. Okay, I can enjoy it like that. And then I started to get interested in, like, okay, who are the weird guys that do this? Like, when the cameras are off, what's happening? How do the politics backstage play out? Who are the actual toughest guys in the ring? So it just kind of stayed with me, and it sort of my interest progressed as I got older. So I can say with some dignity, I'm enjoying it as an adult, but also as a kid at heart.
Well, now you already said Bret Hart was
mm-hmm.
your favorite. I was more of a fan of Owen, God rest his soul, but...
Oh, Owen was fantastic. Tragic end to his life.
It still makes me sad. But
sorry.
Did you have a side that you picked in Hulk Hogan versus Macho Man?
Oh, there wasn't a choice. I was a Randy Savage fan, pillar to post, start to finish. Because, remember, I'm Canadian.
I
grew up, I mean, Hulk Hogan was still the champ, and he was changing wrestling, and he's due all the accolades he's due, but he still came into I Am a Real American. He was the unwavering patriot, and the older you get, the more sort of questions start rolling in your mind about, okay, some of this stuff is cool, and some of this isn't, and I eventually started cheering for, well, it was also very fashionable if you were a young Canadian fan of professional wrestling to hate Hulk Hogan. And my friends and I, you know, basically didn't enjoy his matches because they were very boring. And then we'd see, like, Bret Hart do, like, put on a clinic in 10 minutes and wonder, why isn't he champ? He's like a thousand. Why isn't Ricky Steamboat champion? These guys are amazing. And Hulk Hogan's winning because, you know, he's got the big boot and then the leg drop, and there's a lot of merchandising involved in him being champion. So I was always rooting for the late, great Macho Man Randy Savage. And talking about getting teary-eyed, I still remember where I was when I found out he'd passed away. I was in Aberdeen, Washington, at a Starbucks coming back from a vacation, and I was mortified for days. Because it was a childhood cartoon come to life who was not going to ever, you know, drop the flying elbow from the top rope again. Sad day.
I have another related question, part two of my question. Why do you think vampires like to wrestle?
In my world?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, yeah, not in
the no, in the real world.
Oh, well, I mean,
you know,
maybe
like
you, could check,
like
your sources.
They do.
Yes, I should have footnoted my novel. In my case, I mean, there was the fun of thinking about prey versus predator. I mean,
uh-huh.
that was sort of the, I don't know, the mono tension of the whole thing was, and the underdog theme of, you know, Sakura, by looking at her and knowing her biological makeup, there was no betting man would have put money on that horse.
Sure.
And I also like the fact that, at least in my world, the kind of MMA fighting that was going on with the sort of in Cascadia with the best of the best vampires was boring. Because, you know, they're the fastest things on 2 feet. They destroy their opponents. One, or as they say in the wrestling biz, it's a squash match. You walk in, you crush the person, he looks awesome, you leave. No drama besides a minor spike. So the whole thrust of the book was to get interest back in it. You'd have to tell one hell of an underdog story, and that becomes Sakura's journey.
So before we get into talking about Death Match, which I'm super excited to talk about because I really enjoyed the book, I have one question for you.
Sure.
In a fight between Macho Man, Randy Savage, and Spider-Man,
ooh,
who would win?
Yeah, tough call. What's so hilarious is that Randy Savage actually modeled a lot of his movements on Spider-Man, at least when he initially debuted in the WWE.
Of course I knew that. I didn't
of
know
course.
That. I can see that, actually. I did not know that in advance, but now that you say it, that's
I saw his debut match, and
he
was
see it in the hands.
Working.
Yeah.
He was working it, like the bowed legs and climbing the ropes like he was Spider-Man, which made him so much more compelling. So, I'm a die-hard webhead, so this is a tough call. But I'm going to have to go with The Amazing Spider-Man.
Mm. Ooh.
Because he
Obviously, I agree, because I wouldn't have brought the question up if I didn't, because I don't know anything about wrestling, really. I know some of the names, but I'm drinking my beer out of a Spider-Man pint glass right now. So.
Rudy had asked me that earlier, and I said it kind of depended on what Macho Man's backstory was going to be that week.
If the story demanded that Spider-Man take a fall, he would take a fall.
Exactly. like if whatever his arc was, if he needed to be the hero, then he might have got on top there.
And I will concede that perhaps depends on where in Spider-Man's story arc we are.
We're crossing universes. This is great.
If we're into some Venom stuff, then definitely Macho Man's winning.
Right. Well, and sometimes, sometimes Spider-Man was the good guy, but they thought he was the bad guy, and, you know, like, I get it. It works, the whole soap opera thing with wrestling. Comic books are a lot the same in that. Yeah, I said it. What? Come at me on the comments of this episode. Comic books and wrestling are both soap operas.
Totally. Anyone who disagrees is either a fool or deaf.
I would have went with Hogan's Heroes, brother.
I'm sorry, I did not eat.
Camp, little dude.
So, one of the things we do when we have a lot of content, because here's the deal, right? And I'm going to say it for the record, because I've had enough to drink. Sometimes we get people who send us a lot of content.
Right.
When we're preparing for a show, and sometimes we have people who send us nothing.
But they just come in out of the rain?
Right. But anyway, when we get a lot of content, we kind of split it up.
So sure.
We can cover everything as wholly as it deserves, because if we had to read like 3 books a week, it would just be like, right, and there were vampires, and then, like, the guy wore a Johnny Cash belt buckle or something.
That's a lot, yeah.
So in our little staff messaging group in Facebook, I gave my write-up of Deathmatch, and I said, you know, the end. Or is it? Because your bio hints at the fact that there are more Spar Battersea novels.
Oh, yes.
Are they out there in the world that
I'm,
just don't know that, or are they not out there yet?
Oh, no, they're available. I mean, you guys have been doing human service covering 3 books, so don't feel bad at all. And I'm a prodigious fellow. I'm a busy beaver. So there are two books after Deathmatch. There is Con Job, where our hero Spar Battersea is stuck working at a comic book convention when he finds out one of his ex-girlfriends is a booth babe, and she's gone missing. Hilarity ensues. And it's told in the, it's a very tightly paced book, even more so than Deathmatch, because it takes place in one day at a massive comic book convention, which is like functional definition of health or SPAR. Not a big fan of crowds, not a big fan of nerds, not a big fan of people. And the follow-on after that one is Dice Roll, which is about a cult that starts killing people who play Dungeons and Dragons-esque games in Spar's hometown, and one of his old friends from when he was a real crap disturber returns and is a born-again evangelical. It is probably the grimmest of the Spar books. For some people, it's among their favorites, and it was the first time I got to push Spar back sort of to the threshold, not only to do with and I've said this before about, like, one of the reasons I wrote these Spar Battersea thrillers was I read a lot of thrillers and I didn't enjoy them. And I didn't enjoy them for a bunch of reasons, but one of them was the heroes didn't get hurt, or if they got hurt, it didn't matter. And Spar gets hurt, he stays hurt, he doesn't like to get hurt. And so by the end of Dice Roll, as I said to somebody else who asked me, is there going to be another one? I'm like, if there is, it'll likely have to be the last, because at the end of Dice Roll, he's a bag of bones. He's barely holding on to what he's got.
And I mean, personally, as a punk rocker and a fan of Johnny Cash, I fucking love Spar. Like I said in the pre-show meeting, like, I think I dated him in college. I don't like that guy, like the real guy, you know, anymore, obviously.
Right.
But I get to experience Spar at a distance, so it's cool, right? But that leads me to my question, is that, you know, so many things that I just, like, I was cracking up. Like, it's terrible. I do most of my reading in bed because I have a toddler at home, so I have to put her to bed if I want any quiet time. And I'm, like, cracking up, laughing out loud, and my husband's, like, you know, waking up, like, what? And he's expecting me to read him something funny, but it's something he doesn't get because he was, like, an English goth, like, 10 years before I was in high school. It just doesn't compute. But, like, you know, Spar's going around with his Johnny Cash belt buckle and, like, his jacket that says country on the back, and it's spelled in a very specific way. Listeners at home, I'll let your imagination do the job. So my number one question, because I used to joke in high school that I was into folk punk rock, and then it became a thing. So what is country punk?
Good question. For me, when I heard it the first time, it would be the progenitors of what people today call either No Depression or alt country, like the first Uncle Tupelo album, which was aggressive and raw, but also had like a CCR kind of backbeat to it. You could have like totally. There's a bunch of other bands from that era that I found out about much later, but Uncle Tupelo was my door into that world, because I was a huge Replacements fan. I loved Husker Du. I loved the sort of 80s post-punk sound. It was sort of dying while I was getting into it, so when it died, I gravitated towards bands that were influenced by them, and Uncle Tupelo and later Whiskey Town before Ryan Adams started to go nuts. like seriously, like wackadoodle nuts. And I say this with a lot of admiration for his songwriting ability, and I'm a prodigious guy too. He needs to separate the wheat from the chaff sometime, but also a fine songwriter. But so bands that sort of grew up, not the DC3. They were a terrible metal band.
Are we thinking like Hank the Third?
Somewhat Hank the Third. Also, there was a band called Flat Top that were really good, that were just dirgy three chord. Sounded like it was recorded at Sun Records, but everyone's distortion was cranked up. That kind of stuff, roots-oriented country and punk music sort of fused together. Or I don't know if you ever heard it when the Super Suckers put out an entire double country album. It's
okay.
Brilliant. It's utterly brilliant. Willie Nelson's on it. It's fantastic stuff.
Oh, well, and that's the thing is, I feel like, you know, punk rockers will be like the first people who like fuck country, but then you do have people like, you know, Johnny Cash. I'm sorry, gonna roll back to college again. Johnny Cash is the great grandfather of everything that is punk. And
absolutely,
anybody besides that hasn't really listened to what he like. Maybe they listened to the shit their grandma listened to, which was like, you know, the Sunshine, whatever. What was it? The Orange Blossom Express or the Gospel?
Yes, modern country is horrible.
Oh, it's basically
but
pop music now. But
if you go back to some of those origin things, they're really good.
Oh, those Roots fans. Go ahead.
I was a huge fan of the original Hank Williams. Huge
sure.
fan of Johnny Cash because I did grow up listening to it with my grandparents. And then, you know, I hit a point where I was like, for a moment, like I really had to sit down and figure out who wrote Hurt first. Was it the Nine Inch Nails of Johnny Cash? Because when he sang it, he owned it. And also,
oh, he did
yeah. better when Johnny Cash does it for sure, but
it
was a cover,
was.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that
yeah,
was one of the few times where I heard a cover song. And I was a fan of the Nine Inch Nails original, but
mm-hmm.
that version, especially the video, like on its own, the
yes.
music is also is slaughtering. But with the video, I went, wow, he wrote his own eulogy, or he's performing his own eulogy. Oh, my God.
It is incredibly powerful, yes. That is one of the
And that was one of the first videos in a long time that actually meant anything. If I can say it, I don't know if you're like, if our listeners out there, if we have like Nicki Minaj fans listening to this, they're like, oh no, you don't understand music videos. But like that was the first, like was a really long period of time where music videos just really sucked. And then Johnny Cash came out with that and you're like, holy fucking shit. And then
it was an
art
form when he did it. Yes.
Yeah.
I remember I actually didn't know it had come out, and my dissertation supervisor called me because I'd written Johnny Cash's obituary for the local paper, and I literally said, Johnny Cash is punk rock, screw you.
Yeah.
And I got this phone call. He's like, have you seen the video for the Nine Inch Nails song he covered? I'm like, what? No. And went back and caught it, and just it's one of those
it's okay to
times
say
where
you're
watching something and like time just. It stops, and you're completely absorbed, and you can't look away. And that's the sign of an artist. I mean, he just nailed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder, I genuinely wonder if Trent Reznor, like a part of him, just really regrets allowing that to happen. You know what I mean?
No, I think it'd probably be the opposite. It's like, I created something magnificent, and a man whose talent is was sort of almost bottomless looked at me and said, you've done great work. Can I please borrow your song?
Exactly. I think that would
be
one of the best honors you could have.
But then there's the other side of it where that guy who borrowed it completely owned it, and there's a generation of people who maybe never listened to the Nine Inch Nails that are like, yeah, it's a Johnny Cash song.
But that's okay, too. That's okay. I remember an interviewer pushing Kris Kristofferson to be mad about Janis Joplin's version of Me and Bobby McGee, which he wrote.
Yeah.
And he just got his, you know, that furrowed brow of Kris Kristofferson and goes, looks at the guy and just pointed and he's like, you're trying to make me mad about a woman doing something beautiful with my music. It ain't going to work.
Oh, that's pretty fucking badass.
Yeah.
We're running really super short on time.
Oh.
I told Jessica Turner, like, the whole show talking about the book she read.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but I really
monopolized the show, Renee.
I know. I'm not used to it. there were a couple of things I wanted to ask, and I hope everybody goes out and reads Deathmatch, because if you read it and you enjoy it, you're my people.
Love it.
One of the questions I have is that first of all, the name Spartak Battersea, it feels deliberate to me. And he talks about his name being really recognizable and being different and all that a few times throughout the book. So my question, I guess, is, was it deliberate? Like, is there something that were like that you were going for with the name Spartak Battersea, or is it something that you were like, that sounds cool, because it does?
No, it was deliberate. I'm British Irish on one side and Latvian on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have the last name of a Batman villain. So I have spent my entire life being sort of either a punchline or a joke waiting to happen when it comes to names and stuff. And I know more than most what it means to have a name represent something and how that can be both. You know, it's good. A lot of people remember my name, but it, you know, when you're a kid, it can be kind of bad. And I thought, with if I'm going to write a character that's, you know, and Spar is many things, but Spar is kind of like the worst of the worst that I saw when I was in a punk rock band for years. When it came to sort of nihilistic behavior, and then trying to give that kind of character a second chance story. I wanted him to have a name that was both that reflected both of his cultures. His mother's Russian. His father is British, and that's why he has a British last name. And the way the deal was, all, you know, the family's going to get the last name of the father. Mom gets to pick the first name, and she picks Spartak. And his family relationships become sort of more important as the books go along. But I wanted to give him a name that reflected his attitude. And it would sort of be, his name. He could never escape it, even though his personality changed. And that was part of the emotional thrust, especially of Deathmatch, where he's like, I have to go back to the places where I used to hang out, and I was a first-class jackass. So I wanted to make sure it was a name that not only you remembered, but reflected his character and the journey he was going on. That was pretty deliberate.
So, like I said, we're running short on time, so I'm just going to, like, hit you with a bunch of shit. The other thing I noticed about Deathmatch, besides the fact that, like, you know, some of your novels are about vampires wrestling and some of them are about clowns wrestling, there seem to be a lot of hypocrites in your story, right? So you have, like, the hardcore straight edger guy who's, like, dealing drugs on the side.
Yes.
I ask, okay, because here's the thing, like, right? I was a straight edge kid. In a town that didn't really, like, we were a little town. So all it meant was, like, don't offer me drugs at the show. Like, that's all it meant. Like, nobody had a thing about it. But then I would encounter these people who were like, you can't be straight edge because you swear. And weird shit like that. And obviously I swear. And I'm not straight edge anymore because I opened the show talking about what I'm drinking. Anyway, I was wondering if these were, like, if with your experiences as a punk rocker, like, are these based on people that you actually encountered? Like, is the straight edge character, like, a caricature of somebody that you knew? Or, like, and it happens throughout the book, there are a few kind of borderline hypocrites, but straight edge guys, obviously, like, the biggest one. Is that, like, based in some version of reality, or is it something that you're like, man, straight edge kids, fucking, they're dicks. Let's put it to them. Because now that I'm an adult and I, like, encounter straight edge people, I kind of feel like they're dicks.
Well, I wouldn't say they're all, I can't even remember the name of the character, but the drug dealer who's straight edge, who is dealing all the steroids to the guys at the weightlifting shop. That is loosely based on some experiences I had with straight edge folks. I didn't know a lot of folks who were straight edge. I was probably friends more with the drunk punk set. But the straight edgers that I did know could oscillate from being, you know, really great, did a lot of great stuff for their communities, and were very, you know, a positive influence to a lot of people around them that needed it. And a lot of them were righteous jerks who thought they were better than you as soon as they walked in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Without even, and they could be the most one-way thinking, sort of unaccommodating, no context matters, righteous fundamentalists that you could encounter. Not all of them, but some of them, and male lines.
Well, a lot of them. Let's be honest.
Well, I can't.
They also mock like assholes.
because they're never getting tired because they just got all that protein energy. Because they've just been drinking protein shakes all night while you've been wasting your life having a beer.
We're too hungover to fight them. That's the problem here.
Yeah, we'll get to that tomorrow.
Okay, level with me for a second, because
sure,
you might be the only guest on the show that we've had that's going to understand this. They don't dance like other punk rockers dance. And that was the thing. That was what set me apart, I guess, is that I was just there to, like skank and circle pit and, like, have a good time. But then one time, like, the tightest guy punched me in the ear, and my earring punched a hole in my neck, and I couldn't hear out of my ear for, like, a year. Like, it's not normal.
No, that's called assault.
You got attacked, girl. I don't know.
There's no subculture where that's okay. We're the punch punks, man. Just take it. No,
like I got like because there's like the straight edge pit happening, and then there was like everybody else, and like I somehow got pushed out past the buffers and straight into somebody's fist because all they do is just swing their fists and their feet around, and it's scary. It was like,
to be honest, I saw more of that from guys who were on speed than I did from straight edge kids.
Yeah.
The ones that you could just tell because there was no focus, right? They were just in their own world. Straight edge kids usually had a bit more, I don't know, a 360 degree situational awareness. But the meth heads or the speed freaks that
maybe it was a meth head posing as a straight edge guy.
Oh,
because
the other scary thing that happened to me when I was the scariest moment of my life was I was at Warped Tour back when Warped Tour didn't suck, and NXT ever playing on the stage before the band I wanted to see, and I ended up in the mosh pit, and those fucking Christian punk rockers, they have no other outlet, okay?
Oh man, terrifying.
Like I got pushed to the ground, like, okay, because if you're at, like, an underground show, and, like, you know, even to an extent at some place like Warped Tour, you get pushed to the ground, and somebody helps you up, and everything's okay. Well, I got pushed to the ground, and people were just stepping on me and jumping over me, and I couldn't get up, and, like, some random dude had to, like, pick me up by the collar of my shirt and stand me on my feet and ask me if I was okay. Like, I've had
such
a lot of skinheads.
Wow, that's
really short. But when you're face down on the ground, we're all pretty much at the same height, for Christ's sake.
No. We have different thicknesses.
I mean, I was a lot skinnier then, so maybe they just didn't see me. I don't know.
Well, as long as they weren't, like, chanting to themselves, burn the witch, burn the witch.
More than likely.
People wearing short shorts and spaghetti straps.
That's not in the Bible.
Okay.
I have an important listener question.
All right.
Seriously. This is from J. David Osborne, and it came to me just seconds ago. Do you like the Smashing Pumpkins?
No,
ooh.
Highly overrated, and Corgan's vocal stylings make Geddy Lee look like Neil Young.
All right.
Ooh, that's rough.
An end of
okay.
That. I did like them when I was in high school. I won't pretend I didn't.
I liked a couple of albums,
but I'm.
I never enjoyed them. I saw one video of theirs that I liked before they sort of went cosmic when I was in high school, and I have to admit I had a natural predilection for hating anything that became popular because I was an idiot at 17. So I should be fair and say I don't like them. I never have, but
You're in the majority, I'll tell you that much.
Can I be an asshole real quick?
You don't have to apologize.
I was in junior high.
What now?
When they went cosmic, I was in junior high, so I have lots of excuses. Anyway, I have two quick, like super fast listener questions.
I can do it.
And they relate to each other. So I want to know what led you to leave Canada and relocate to California. And Cameron Pierce wants to know, where in Northern California do you live? And maybe your address. I don't know, because I felt like that was a good question. But he asked.
That might be a little too creepy, so you can just...
Yeah, that's... Suffice to say, I live in parts unknown Northern California.
I mean, he seems like a nice dude.
There are a lot of nice dudes that don't need to know where I live. Riddlerville is off limits.
I've said that much myself, yeah.
Yeah.
To answer the first question, I fell in love with an American woman, and I married her and moved down here as part of the journey.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that happened to my my current husband with his ex-wife, and I'm really glad it happened because he's my husband now. So.
Ah, lovely.
There you go. All right, so we're over time now, and that should happen, and I think that we're all drunk. I mean, I don't know if Jason's
wait,
drunk.
Wait.
I have no idea.
I have a last question.
I don't know.
I have a last question.
Oh, wait, Dakota has a last question.
Of course
question.
You fucking do. Okay, go for it.
I haven't done it. I haven't done it in a while. Okay, so I might not, like, talk to another historian for, like, who knows when. You just don't do that.
No, they're boring as hell.
I mean, maybe run into a gin bar. You know, I don't know.
the historian gin bar where we all hang out in our tweed jackets and smell like chalk.
I hope that's accurate. My
right,
question
what
is,
do you need to know?
What is your favorite Shakespeare play?
Well, he's a war historian.
Yeah.
So you're a historian, right?
That was amazing.
So what's five times seven?
I'm too drunk to answer that question. What is five times seven?
I'll answer that.
What's your favorite?
Favorite Shakespeare play? I've got
there was a war in Macbeth.
There were many wars in Shakespeare's plays. Well,
it had me thinking about it. Yeah.
Hank Sank with, you know, we few, lucky few, we band of brothers and all that junk. But I'd have to say The Tempest.
Thank Christmas Day. Sorry. I know my out-of-context Shakespeare.
Come on, shout out your favorite line from King Lear now!
Dance, monkey, dance!
I was gonna ask like a dumber question, like who would win against, you know, Da Vinci versus Mozart, and then I was like, well, hey, Shakespeare, what about
Da Vinci would totally win. He was an inventor. He would invent. He's invented weapons of war. Come on, Christ.
What about hand to hand?
Oh, Mozart was deadly. He knew Gymkhana.
Oh, there you go. With qualifiers.
There's your answer.
In the words of William Shakespeare, so runs the world away.
Indeed.
We may be getting close on time.
We were over time before Dakota started talking. Okay.
Did he answer? Did he tell me? I don't think he did.
That was Hamlet, by the way.
Oh.
Be educated.
Wait, so what is your favorite Shakespeare? Because Dakota really needs to know.
Oh, well, it's a steel cage match fight between The Tempest and Macbeth.
There you go.
Nice.
Ah.
MacDougall was
my favorite.
Womb untimely ripped. That's
ooh.
Right?
So,
yes. I actually referenced Macbeth in a
really
joke
do know it.
A while ago because I'm that geeky. My friend sent me a birthday card that was like, happy anniversary of the day you shot out of your mother's vagina. And when I thanked her, I said, no.
Did you say you were from
Macbeth? I was ripped from
you were from your mother's family rips?
Yeah.
That's kind of awesome.
I did that because I'm a fucking nerd. As obviously by whatever, I'm drunk.
Word up.
It's made obvious by my Spider-Man references. And, you know, we're 6 minutes over time and I haven't taken care of business yet. Once again, being sponsored by the Booked Anthology, which was put together by the Booked Podcast, which being a podcast that talks about books that came after Booked, we have to recognize that they're like our friendly big brothers that have been really good to us and paved the way for us. And I'll repeat that a lot of the people that we've had on the show that you've listened to and loved are featured in that anthology. The Booked guys are great guys. Go out and buy the fucking book. But also remember that we have a book coming up soon. And don't forget to buy that when it comes out because that's we need your money.
Desperately, we do.
Don't we all?
And Jason, thanks so much for a great show.
Well, thanks a lot for having
me,
guys. It's been a blast.
Yeah,
if, as you well know, I've got more than a few books kicking around, so if you're ever hurting for a guest, be sure to call.
We will.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope you realize that now we're best friends, and that's just something that happens sometimes, and I hope you're okay with it.
It's a rare occasion that I get to quote Shakespeare while I'm drunk, so thank you.
It's a rare occasion where I get to ask somebody one of these comic book questions that involves who would win in a fight, and the guest actually has an answer.
Oh, so. I think it's rather pathetic, but I always have an answer.
So, yeah, no, thanks again. Oh, and for the listeners, because I forgot about you guys for a minute, but don't worry, it doesn't happen often. We love you. We're going to listen to a song. You finish your drink. And next week, we're going to be back with Scott Phillips. And
that's exciting.
Fucking amazing. Are you kidding? I just watched The Ice Harvest on Netflix, and I'm, like, super stoked because he was talking about how, like, one of the characters changed between the novel and the movie, and I'm ready to talk to him about that.
Okay.
So it's going to be a great show, and, again, thank you, Jason. This is great. And
cheers.
You know, finish your drink unless you're driving, then you shouldn't be drinking to begin with. Listen to the song, come back next week, click the links, click the banner at the bottom of the page to buy the book anthology, and have a good weekend.